to think of something you can't do, right? Like make a list of some things you can't do, right? Like you run a marathon, learn calculus, whatever it is. And then what you should do is you should do one of those things. And because once you do that, it's like the ceiling on your life is just gone.
Hi, everyone. This is Josephine Elia. In this reading interview series, I chat with bookworms, avid readers, and learners to unpack their reading habits and philosophy. Physicist Alan Lightman wrote A Meditation on Science and Spirituality. For me, there is room for both a spiritual universe and a physical universe, just as there is room for both religion and science. Each universe has its own power. Each has its own beauty and mystery. A Presbyterian minister recently said to me that science and religion share a sense of wonder. I agree. This quote kept popping into my mind during this conversation with Anthony Bosman, a mathematician and assistant professor at Andrews University. He's very passionate about his field, as you'll hear in this interview. So naturally, we talked about math quite a bit. If math gives you an uneasy feeling, hang in there for a few minutes and we'll eventually get to his reading life and how that influences his teaching and life philosophy. Please enjoy this conversation with Anthony Bosman. So, Anthony, I typically start with a question on reading, but I guess before that, though, could you share a little bit about yourself, what you're doing right now and where you are, just by way of introduction for the listeners?
Yeah, excellent. Well, first of all, thank you for having me, Josephine. I'm thrilled to be joining this conversation. I serve as an assistant professor of mathematics at Andrews University, which is in Southwest Michigan.
So your activity includes both teaching and research, I'm guessing.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So since you're a mathematician, I'm actually curious to begin with your story with math. How do you ended up in the field and, you know, how your interest grew over the years?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So when I was a kid, I was just a math geek. My mom tells the story that she claims that the first word I ever spoke in school was answering a math question. I was a very quiet, very shy kid, but one day the teacher asked a question and I answered. And since then, I was kind of the math geek, you know. Going into high school, that very much continued, but I had one or two math teachers who were very influential mentors, I would say. Mm-hmm. And they also kind of brought me more into the math as a means of service, so tutoring and teaching others. And so that was a way in which math wasn't just something I was really good at, but it was a way I could begin to help my classmates. And so when I went to university, I knew I really enjoyed math. I'd done a whole lot of math in high school. And so I knew I really wanted to pursue that, but I was curious, you know, maybe I want to do something that's mathy, but not math itself, right? Mm-hmm. Like physics or economics. So I took some of these courses. But when I took them, I kept enjoying the math aspect of them. So I'd come back and decide, you know, continue in math, finish undergraduate. And, you know, it's like when you finish an undergraduate degree in mathematics, what do you do next? Well, more math. So I went to grad school and completed my PhD about a year ago.
Okay.
So, yeah, the mathematics I study it's on the pure side. So it's kind of a spectrum in mathematics of how pure versus how applied your material is. I'm very pure. It's an area of math called topology, which is geometry, but without the – it's a little bit like loose geometry. You might think it's like drunken geometry. It's a little bit less of freedom, a little bit more freedom. And I'm studying particular knots, like you tie something to a knot. Mm-hmm. So the mathematics of knots – but as a way to get a grasp of understanding three- and four-dimensional objects. And so there's this really cool sense in which knots, you know, tie something to a knot, kind of serve as a bridge to understanding four-dimensional objects. And I just find it fantastic.
That is so beyond what I can understand, trying to understand knots in four-dimensional objects. So it's theoretical? Your research is theoretical? And no application at all?
Yeah, you know, there are aspects of knot theory, which is the area of study, which touches upon applications, like the knotting of DNA, things of this nature. But that's not what I study. And so while sometimes you go to conferences, I hear a talk on this, I'll find it fascinating, my research itself doesn't directly engage with any of those applications.
So how does the mechanism of research, I guess my reference point, you know, I did
my PhD in engineering, and my colleagues were actually studying protein folding and the novel protein design and all these things. But I would assume that the research mechanism is very different in theoretical math. Like, what's the mechanism of the day-to-day activity of your research?
Yeah, it's a lot of thinking. So you think really hard.
Okay.
And so, there is still this basic structure of you have some problem in mind. You read the literature. So you're like going through the literature. As you're going through it, you're looking for tools and methods that other people have applied to other problems.
Okay.
And maybe trying to strengthen them and generalize them. And then you're trying to see, can I apply that to my problem? A lot of times you find out that the problem like I had is not a very good problem. It's too difficult. It's too easy. And so you kind of end up by tweaking the problem, the original question, to a question that you're better at answering. And so there's this back and forth of trying to come up with good questions and then looking at the literature and figuring out what methods you have. And eventually you're trying to get down to, okay, can I say something meaningful that hasn't been said yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I really like to think about mathematics as an ongoing conversation or an ongoing project where for, 3,000 years, humanity has been having this conversation about mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just trying to continue to expand this dialogue.
Awesome. Well, I love that you're so passionate about it. that's really awesome. So you don't have students. Do you have students that you supervise for research?
Ah, great. Yeah. So the institution I'm at, it focuses on undergraduate education for mathematics.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But we do encourage quite a bit of undergraduate research. And so I've just arrived, so I'm new on the block.
Mm-hmm.
But I have secured some grant funds to support some undergraduates in some undergraduate projects in the upcoming year. And this is actually something that really drew me to Andrews was the ability to mentor undergraduates, both in the classroom, but then through these research projects and kind of track with them for 2, 3, 4 years and really see them develop in their thinking.
Okay. That's awesome. Yeah. Wonderful. I'll go back to this math and teaching a bit later. But so one of the main questions I like to ask people on the podcast is to tell your life story in terms of books. In terms of titles, book titles that have impacted your life one way or another, how they have shaped you as a person right now. So if you could share a little bit of your story, are there books that have impacted you and shaped you?
Yeah. If I go to my early life, linking like elementary school, middle school into high school, probably some of the most influential books would unsurprisingly be math books, right?
Okay.
One particular author that comes to mind is Ian Sturt. He writes a number of math books for a broad audience, a popular audience. And there's one in particular he writes that's called Flatterland. So Flatland is a classic in mathematics. Flatland is it's like a 100-year-old classic on imagining a two-dimensional world and what would this two-dimensional world be like and what would it be like to live in this two-dimensional world. So Ian Sturt wrote this like sequel, right? It's like a follow-up to this classic called Flatterland, where this two-dimensional object enters into the three-dimensional universe and begins exploring all these different aspects of, well, it's like a mathematical universe. It goes on this epic journey encountering different kinds of mathematical objects. So one of them is called a Mobius cow. It's a one-sided cow. And so you began to introduce ideas of one-sidedness versus two-sidedness. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so some really fun math ideas that are usually not accessible until you're a little bit more advanced in your mathematics. He makes accessible through some really fun storytelling. And so I found just the epic journey combined with these really cool ideas. I found a really neat combination, which I think that was seventh grade is when I read that book. And it really pulled me in to.
Were your parents like in in related fields at all, or
no? So that's a question I get a lot. My mom has been kind of a jack of all trades, and then my dad has he did a lot of work with FedEx and some other shipping companies, and so neither of them were like the math geek or the nutty math professor or anything like that. Some of the largest influence, maybe a handful of teachers I had at school who took a special interest, a special investment, that really helped. I had a high school teacher who you know, exposed me to his like college live, you know, his college collection of college books, and let me go through some of his, you know, college math textbooks. And I think that was healthy because in high school, I was very used to like instantly understanding something when it's presented to me. And this was like, whoa, this stuff is really hard and really complicated. And I'm totally confused and totally lost. And I think it was really healthy for me to see that there's a richness to the subject where I'm able to, you know, there's a deep end, right? That I can swim in this deep end, and if the waters are rougher here, it's not just I'll always be in control of everything.
That's awesome. Yeah. So sorry, I interrupted. You were in seventh grade, and you got this book.
Oh, Flatulence. Yes, that was a great one. And then throughout high school, other, especially like math biographies. Fermat's Enigma comes to mind. It's a really great book that tells the history of something called Fermat's Last Theorem, which was this mathematical theorem that took us 300 years to prove. And so it's a really cool story. It brings in a lot of fun of mathematical characters, so a lot of the biography of the various individuals who worked on this problem. And yeah, I really enjoyed these in high school, and I think they kind of gave me a way of viewing myself, right? It's like it helped me place myself within this community, within this context.
And then did the types of books change or expand, you know, as you went to college or further on?
Yeah, I think once I got into college and then, you know, throughout undergraduate and into grad school, I was immersed in the math so much, my books became an outlet to expose me to different fields or different domains, right? So throughout high school, at the beginning of college, you have a very diverse set of classes you're taking. And while I mentioned I was a math geek, I wasn't just a math geek. I was just like a geek, right? Like I was a philosophy geek. I was, you know, a history geek, whatever. Whatever class I was taking, I tend to really enjoy it. And so as I advanced throughout my undergraduate degree and into graduate school, as the classes I'm taking began to narrow, I was like, wow, I'm still really interested in the other questions these other domains are asking about. And so books became an outlet to begin to engage with some of those other questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really awesome. I mean, one of the main things I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, you're in the math field, and I feel a little bit of kindred spirit because most of the books that I read for fun, not for work or for research, is in other domains and other disciplines. And for me, I feel a sense of need to do that. So why is it important for you to read widely in across disciplines?
Yeah. So maybe there are two things I can say here. The first is, I think something that I appreciate about math is because it's pretty fundamental, right? It's like teaching you to think well and think critically. I find that it's a pretty cool launching point to go into lots of different domains. And so I think that it's a cool foundation from there I can launch into lots of different things. Although perhaps also I have some like angst with my work because it is so theoretical and it is so like, you know, four-dimensional objects. And, you know, it's like I want something to ground me. You know, it's like this is I love thinking about it. I love it. But sometimes I'm like, you know, I can't be up in these clouds all day. I want to be grounded, engage with all these other really meaningful questions that are, you know, taking discussions going on in society right now. And so there's maybe a tension there as well. It's like I love math because it allows me to access lots of different modalities of thinking. And at the same time, I'm trying to escape from it. I'm trying to have a broader worldview, a broader participation.
Do you have kind of like ways to reflect or were there examples where you reflect how you kind of integrate all this different knowledge for yourself?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, maybe the first thing I say about integration is there are very few books I haven't read and enjoyed, but at the same time, there are very, very few books I would recommend to someone else because it's the saying that in most books, I feel very conflicted. Like it's oh, there's some really good stuff in here. I value it. And there's a lot of stuff in there. And it's like, oh, that's not completely true. So I can't give this to a freshman because, you know, what if they're led astray or whatever? So it is a thoughtful integration, I would say. As for how I do it, I think definitely thinking systematically, which is something I get from maybe my time in doing mathematics, is helpful. But maybe the other side of it that kind of helps balance it out is just the role of faith in my life. Mm-hmm. And so for me, Christianity provides a really comprehensive worldview that's able to give me a way to engage with all these questions, be it questions about education or about justice or about whatever it may be, the sciences or whatever it may be. And so I find that having that faith perspective allows me to, both be interested and motivated to pursue all these different things, because it's a faith that tries to engage with the whole world, but also it gives me then an in to begin to piece these things together in a meaningful way, really not just like this is how I should think and this is what is true, but this is how I can live, this is what it looks like when this thing is played out.
Right, right. Yeah, I love that, that it's not just an abstract concept, but mm-hmm. perhaps because I'm in the engineering field, it's always, yeah. I mean, I'm always interested in applying principles into the ground, into the real life, and I think faith is one of those things, it's important to not just be abstract. I know for me, I ask a lot of the question a lot, what does it mean to be in my field, to be an engineer, through the lens of my faith and the way I realize myself in the world,
So this is a tension that I wrestle with a lot, is the tension between the abstract, the theoretical, and the applied.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I love my engineering, friends who, like, in undergraduate, they got to, like, build the cool toys, right? Like, they were, like, in the, building all the stuff all night, and I was, like, working on equations, and I thought they were doing such cool stuff. And so I've often felt this tension between, it's like, oh, I'm really, really interested in these, like, a very broad, pure theoretical questions, and yet, I love to see something, like, pure, I love to see, like, some application come out of this. I love to see this, like, have some punch, right? Mm-hmm. I think one thing in particular in Christianity that is really neat to kind of bridge these two is just the idea of incarnation. And so somehow it's like, the theoretical side of Christianity, the God, all these concepts that are very like high and lofty, four dimensional, kind of stuff would be the analog, right? Mm-hmm. Somehow it gets like played out in the life of a very concrete, physical, it's a person living this life, a historical individual who's like coming across like these, everyday experiences. And so that for me, I'm like, wow, that's a really powerful way that there's a bridge between the theoretical and the applied. And so I don't know exactly like how that idea translates to every kind of domain, but I find there's a richness to that theme that, hey, somehow in my own life, I should be trying to see how can I integrate the theoretical with the practical. How can I myself be living out this maybe incarnation principle that as I'm reflecting on these grand themes, I want to be living them out as well.
Right, right, right. Absolutely. I don't know if you feel this way, but sometimes I feel a little disembodied, because like I'm always in my head or, mostly being introverted or in this type of field, you're like always in your head and sometimes you play with abstract ideas so well, but then, like practical life, like, oh man, I'm so deficient in the physical world. Yeah.
Someone gave me this advice before I went off to college where he's like, you need to get like a bag of concrete and keep it in your room. And like, so it remind you to like be grounded. And I thought it was like the weirdest advice, but since then I'm like, okay, I hear what he's saying. Like I see that in myself, a tendency to, when some discussion's going on, I'm looking for like what's the principle here? How can we abstract this? How can we, and I'm, I'm up here like in the sky and I've totally detached myself from the, and I mean, that's super valuable. I mean, that's, a really valuable skill. But then once you do that work in the abstraction, how can you bring it back down what impact
you have? Mm-hmm. Did you put that concrete in your room?
No.
It's like a visual reminder.
Yeah.
Do you have certain things that you do to kind of ground yourself? Mm. I mean, aside from books, just like things in your life to balance it out, like certain things, intentional things that you do.
Yeah. So spending time with people, but in particular like, with an intentionality. So especially like in the service context. So when I was in Houston, for instance, I did my PhD at Rice University. So I was in Houston for 5 years. And that was a lot of service with the homeless community. And that was, yeah, that was, I think, especially significant to come face to face and build meaningful relationship with individuals and with a totally different set of experiences. And I think that really helped ground me. A lot of the outlets to service, again, has been through faith, through church community, right? So mm-hmm. it's getting involved with the community, coming like into contact every week with people from totally different different economic classes, different different racial backgrounds, different all the differences, right? Different educational levels, like all these differences, and coming in contact with them and like living in community with these individuals, I found that especially meaningful. I mean, I did undergraduate at Stanford, and so I felt like there was almost a the campus itself is kind of detached from the, you know, there's a mm-hmm. mile long drive of palm trees to get into the campus.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, it's like, it's beautiful, it's magnificent, but it's like you are now leaving planet Earth, entering into, you know,
the bubble. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And you're surrounded, and there was a beautiful diversity at Stanford and Rice as well. But at the same time, it's like, yes, the people here are very different than me, but in some ways they're very similar to me, right, in mm-hmm. terms of educational level. While they try and do pretty good about getting people from different classes and different backgrounds, still it's like we're all pretty similar in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so being in that constant contact through church community and then through other service activities with individuals from a totally different, you know, have totally different experience day to day, I find that's really helpful to keep me grounded.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. It actually reminds me, I'm reading this book by Gregory Boyle. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with, he's a Jesuit priest, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Who works with the kind of former gang members in Los Angeles and trying to, you know, give them jobs and integrate them to society. But he talks a lot about kinship and kind of like an application of that incarnation theology, you know, that sometimes, you know, it was trying to like, it's not that he's there to try to fix these people, but he's there to be with them. So it's not like he has something to give and they're there to receive, but he's actually there to learn and be in kinship, you know, be in a relationship and actually admire each other and have that kind of relationship. And that's kind of like how I think the depth of incarnation, like what you mentioned before, you know, God came down to earth to be with us, not just to provide us blessings, but he came to also be with us and be in kinship with our experiences. So like all of that, I think touched what you mentioned, you know, and the application of that, you know, your involvement in service, it's really important to help us realize that we're here together, you know, that we're not just, so we're here with other people. We're coexisting. We're like living, going through life. So that's wonderful.
Yeah, I love that word kinship. Maybe just go back to clarify or expand what I was saying before. When I talk about service and church community, it's not that I think I'm going to serve these individuals.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's this idea that I can be united with this community from all different kinds of backgrounds and walks,
mm-hmm.
and we are together doing a common service, right?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And that is like what I find so, it's like, wow, I am pulled into this thing that encompasses all these different kinds of people, and that is what I would find really attractive.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Lovely. So in social media, you know, you like to post these thought-provoking questions and statements to kind of engender conversations, to create conversations. And you're very engaged with people, you know, this like deep discussions on Facebook comments, which I think is
You have
great.
Me really worried right now because I have no idea. I'm like, oh, no, what is she going to bring up from social media?
No. You know, I mean, I just noticed, right? Because, and people engage, which is, I think is wonderful, you know, to get a layer of interaction that's deeper than just the normal, you know, our normal social media activities.
Sure.
What's the thought behind this kind of initiative?
Oh, sure. Okay. I don't know if I have like a whole program I'm doing,
no,
right?
Yeah, it's yeah.
Sometimes I just post things because I find them interesting. Mm-hmm. But I am very aware of, and as you can say, concerned about just polarization. Mm-hmm. And among many dimensions, so be it between the political dimension, like political left and political right, or be it along, how differences in geography or differences in race or all these other differences, how they tend to polarize our thinking. And so, yeah, I do very much enjoy having intentional conversations either with those on the opposite side of some issue, right, mm-hmm. or just trying to facilitate some kind of, I don't know if I'm always a centrist on all issues, but try to facilitate a space where it's, hey, I think it's really important that we hear from each other, that we learn from each other. Mm-hmm. This has also been my recent reading from the last, year or so. I've read a number of books in this direction. One that comes to mind is like Jonathan Haidt. He has done some really cool research. So one of his books that came, what's the book? The Righteous Mind. So Jonathan Haidt has a book called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And again, this is not a blanket endorsement of the book. There's very few books I can give a blanket endorsement of. But overall, the thesis of how those on different sides of especially the political spectrum tend to have different moral matrices through which they interpret the world, I find really helpful. And it begins to give me an in to see, okay, this is I can begin to see why we're so divided on these issues. Mm-hmm. What are some other good ones? Oh, I read Political Tribes recently. Mm-hmm. A number of books in this direction is pointing out this problem of, I guess you can say, tribalism, or this problem of entrenchment into a particular view. I actually, the more I look into the data, though, I don't think polarization is the largest problem that we're facing. I think what happens is you have polarization of a few, so there's some very loud voices on the left, some very loud voices on the right. Over the last couple of decades, it's true, those voices have moved further to the left and further to the right. Mm-hmm. So there is that kind of polarization happening. But for the majority of individuals, it seems like they're just, in response to this, they're becoming apathetic. Mm. And so, for instance, we have to contrast like those who watch MSNBC with those who watch Fox News or something. But it's only a couple million, individuals who watch either of these networks.
Right.
And so, of a country of 300 million, it's like, that's not actually that many people. And so what it seems like has happened is the majority, maybe even a significant majority, have seen these loud voices on both sides. And they've just kind of been like, oh, if every time someone from the left and someone from the right talks to each other, it ends in a shouting match, mm-hmm. then that's really, discouraging. And it's not just in politics. It can be, in religion, could be in, any of these, divisive issues. If every time someone from this worldview and this worldview or this background and this background talk to each other, it ends in shouting, it ends in anger, then we're just going to give up on the problem. Mm. And that actually is my bigger concern, is the apathy that's been a response to polarization. So a lot of people just like, oh, when we come together for Thanksgiving, let's not talk about politics or religion or race or any of the hard issues. And I'm like, oh, but these are like really important aspects of what it means to be human, right? This is how we organize ourselves in society. And so my bigger concern would be apathy. And so I really want to engage with that. And how can we bring people in on the discussion? People have really good things to say, and encourage this idea that, hey, in fact, we can talk to each other. We can make some progress on some of these problems. Mm-hmm. That's probably my passion there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of these more kind of like heated issues mm-hmm. Are typically represented in such a binary fashion, right? Like it's just either or, whereas the reality is there's so many nuance and shades in between. So have you found helpful things to facilitate this kind of discussion?
Yeah.
Just, in your recent experiences.
Yep. So if I am going to be like an actor in this conversation, so I'm not just like facilitating, but I'm actually speaking to someone on the other side, mm-hmm. I think it's really important that I probably began with acknowledging what I appreciate about their side, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, maybe it's a difference on some political or some religious or whatever it may be. But I think on most issues, I can at least concede some ground and recognize like that there's something really attractive about what they, you know, it's like, I understand, I should begin by doing the work to be, try to understand,
yep.
like why you'd be drawn to this thing.
Right.
So take something controversial, like guns or whatever. And, you know, it can be like, okay, if I'm talking to someone who's really passionate about, owning a lot of guns, I can be like, oh, I understand why you're drawn to this idea of how you want to be able to protect yourself and your family. And it's like, oh, that's really, you know, that's actually something mm-hmm. I can like resonate with. And I think about it and look at some of the arguments. Or if it's someone on the other side and maybe I'm a little bit concerned that they're going too far in regulating, guns, I should begin with, oh, well, I can really understand why you're outraged by this ongoing problem we have with gun violence. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think whoever I'm talking to on an issue, my first task should be, how am I sympathetic to, what can I appreciate about their position? And I should begin with that. Right. And then not just as a rhetorical device, although it is a good rhetorical way, mm-hmm. you know, it's a good means of having a dialogue.
Yeah.
But it's also because it's probably going to prime me for a much more meaningful conversation as well, and probably set me up to learn a lot more from the conversation as well. And so I really try to foster this, you might call it intellectual humility, you might call it whatever it is, yeah. This openness to a broad set of views.
Right. Do you do this on social media, I know.
Sure.
Do you have kind of like the real life counterparts at Andrews or
yeah.
whether you do it intentionally or just kind of organically?
So I gave a lecture recently, you know, like there's the typical math lectures, and sometimes I try and bring in some of these themes as they apply to some of my courses. But I gave a, you know, throughout the week, they have these other lectures that happen for various colloquium and things like this. And so I was asked to give a lecture to, well, it was like religion and theology students. Mm. But it was open, and so a lot more people came. And since I was giving it from the math department, a lot more like science-y people kind of came too. And so there's this really weird group, and I'm like, oh, what can I say to these students, right? It's like, I'm not a theologian. I'm not, you know, what can I say? And so I gave a talk. I believe it was titled Why You Are – let me try. There's three things I was trying to convince them. I was trying to convince them that they are ignorant, overconfident, and biased.
Lovely.
I had no idea how they're going to respond, but I'm like, yeah. I'm going to try, you know, I spent half the lecture trying to convince them that they are ignorant, overconfident, and biased. And then the second half talking about, okay, how do we as a community, especially in a scholarly context, try to guard against some of these things. And it actually went over quite well. I got some really positive feedback. I mean, I was a little bit concerned, like I'm sitting here telling these students, you know, you're ignorant, you're biased, you're overconfident. I got some really positive feedback, and I find that people are actually drawn to like, hey, if, you know, when you point out, these are my biases, these are just our general human tendencies to, mm-hmm. Towards bias, towards overconfidence. And here's a way forward. I think people are actually pretty drawn towards that.
Mm. What was the message? Was that like psychology?
Yeah,
talk?
it was like drawn from a lot of psychology I've been like reading, recently. You know, so ignorant is just the fact that, well, it's not hard to convince someone they're ignorant. Mm-hmm. You just ask them, like, what have you learned over the last year? And, you know, in college in particular, students can name quite a bit that they've learned over the last year. And then you can be like, well, if that's how much you learned over the last year, how much more do you expect to learn in the upcoming year, right? Like think mm-hmm. back to yourself 5 years ago, and you're like, 5 years ago, I was pretty dumb, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I can recognize that. Like, there's a lot of false beliefs I had. There was a lot of just stuff I thought that was just simply false. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, if that was me 5 years ago, and that's how I view myself now, what will future me 5 years from now, how will that individual view me? So that's, mm-hmm. I don't think that's a difficult case to make. Overconfident, I was appealing to something called the Dunning-Kruger effect. That just is this interesting body research in psychology that shows as you begin to gain some knowledge, your confidence shoots up. And then mm-hmm. as you gain more knowledge, it begins to decrease quite a bit
right.
until you become an expert. When you're an expert, it begins to rebound a little bit because you know you're an expert, but never back to like that sophomore level of confidence where mm-hmm. you think you know it all. I think my favorite analogy for this is of someone standing in a field, and this is like the field of human knowledge. And as you're doing like your undergraduate studies, like maybe freshman and sophomore year, like gen ed requirements, it's like surveying the field. And it's like, okay, I have a pretty good sense of what this field's about. But then you begin digging deep into the ground. This is like complete undergraduate, maybe doing some graduate work. And like the deeper you go in your studies, it's like the deeper you go into the ground. And by the time you finish with, you know, a graduate degree or whatever it is, it's like you have this really deep hole and you look in the hole and it's like it's really complex. And it's like, wow, I thought this was just like a field, but under it is really complicated. And then you realize like if this little plot of land under me is so rich and complicated, probably the rest of the field, if I was to dig into all that, I would realize it too is really rich and complicated. And so you walk away with some level of intellectual humility being like, wow, like this little thing I thought I knew a lot about is a lot more complicated. So probably all those other things that I thought I knew a lot about are a lot more complicated as well.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So kind of going back to math and your, you know, in your being an assistant professor right now, how do you approach teaching math? Do you have kind of like a philosophy of teaching? What's kind of like your higher aim, you know, because I would guess that you're not just teaching math. I'm sure you have like a, a bigger purpose in education.
So there's a lot I can say there. Maybe I would begin by saying, I like this distinction that I don't necessarily teach math, I teach students, right? Mm. And so my teaching is informed by my students, and so I teach them very different classes, some like gen ed math, some, you know, like calculus, kind of like a broad range, and then some more like within the discipline, you know, advanced mathematics. And so what I'm teaching and the way it looks and feels is probably quite different depending upon the audience, and even depending upon the particular batch of students that semester. And so that necessitates I begin to get to know the students, right? I can't just give the same thing every semester. I can't just record myself and put it on the internet. I actually need to like form meaningful connections with my students. I think that along with that, then I try to think of teaching in holistic terms of, you know, teaching is I'm coming along alongside my student, and I have this really privileged role where I'm able to influence who are they becoming, right? Like who is the person they're growing into? And that's kind of terrifying when you think about it, you know? It's like, man, I need to be myself the kind of person I want to be modeling. And so there's a strong challenge within that as well. But then it's, okay, so how can I influence who this person is growing into? A lot of that I find is expressing excitement and awe and wonder at the subject. There's like a contagiousness to that, you know, like math is sometimes kind of scary or daunting, but if I can get excited about it and just, and it's not like a false excitement. I really am excited by this stuff. It's really cool. Hopefully I can move my students as well from apathy, which many of them face, towards, you know, it's like these are these great questions and these great things you have the ability to think about. Like, that's incredible. And just point out, like, you have this really amazing mind that's able to do these really amazing things. And so let's just celebrate that what we're able to do and dig into it. And so I see that comes into quite a bit. As a Christian, I would appeal to language like talking about individuals being made in the image of God. And so I would talk about education isn't just filling them with knowledge, but it's restoring this image of God in them, right? Mm-hmm. It's allowing them to maybe more secular terms be like fully actualized or coming into like, you know, what it means to be fully human, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I could go on about this for a while, but maybe that begins to give some of the pieces. Mindset, I find, matters a lot. So I've become a really big fan of some work by Carol Dweck. She's an educational psychologist at Stanford on growth mindset. There are some similar individuals talking about this stuff. Duckworth talks about grit. So a lot of these ideas are out there now. But just helping students move from a conception of themselves that either I have the gift or I don't have the gift, or I either was given by the gods the math gift or I wasn't. To realize that actually we all were made with the ability to do mathematics. There's some really, really strong evidence about this I can point to. And what matters is having this conception that intelligence is something I can learn. So when I fail, it's not telling me that I can't learn this. Failure is just communicating there's some extra steps we need to take here.
Yeah.
And what I find this does, this is really neat. Okay, so I tell my students this. So this is my advice for like any high school or like college student, or I guess anyone. So what you should do this year is you should find something that you should think of something you can't do, right? Like make a list of some things you can't do, right? Like you run a marathon, learn calculus, whatever it is. And then what you should do is you should do one of those things, mm-hmm. right? Because once you do that, it's like the ceiling on your life is just gone, right? Yeah. It's like, I always had this conception for myself that I could never complete a marathon or learn calculus. And now that I have, it's like, if I can do that, well, what else could I do, right?
Right.
And I find that when I frame it this way, you know, like teaching a student calculus can become this like liberating experience where they're like, whoa, the way I view myself is totally different now, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what gets me excited is when there can actually be a whole change of self-conception.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's awesome. Do you see that in this first year of you teaching? Have you seen that type of
transformation? I was commenting half jokingly but half serious with a colleague the other day. I got back, you know, my teaching evaluations, and I'm like, nobody said this course changed my life. You know, I was like, oh no, I failed because I didn't change anyone's life. Right, right. So I don't know. Maybe there's more work to do. But yeah, I mean, I definitely have like the small moments of that. Yeah. And a lot of this stuff I don't think can be fully recognized like within the span of a semester. Yeah. Right? A lot of times it's like later on students are like reflecting back and they're like, oh, I can see how these handful of experiences helped me overcome this particular conception I had of myself.
Right, you know? Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's not always the heavy rain and the thunderstorm. Sometimes yeah. It's just drip by drip, right? Yeah. What's your experience like contrasting, you know, your undergraduate and graduate experience being in a secular institutions and now being in a religious institution? Mm-hmm. What's your experience like? How is it different? And experience.
Yeah, so I have a friend who, she was a professor at Rice University where I was, but she actually just moved to a religious institution, although mm-hmm. she herself is not religious, which is interesting. She appreciates religion, but she would consider herself, you know, atheist or not necessarily Christian. Mm-hmm. But she comments on how her attention was how the secular university didn't have a clear mission. Mm-hmm. And what there was a lot of different forces trying to pull the institution in a lot of different directions, right? Like, oh, we want to be a research institution, so we're trying to get, like, the best citations or whatever it may be. Or there's maybe another goal for the institution of, you know, the best kind of undergraduate education, but then what is education? So there's this big question of what should education be doing? Are we making individuals really technical and proficient in the fields? Are we trying to impact society? Are we trying, you know, what are we doing? And so it can often feel this way that at a secular institution that there are a lot of forces pulling you different directions. That's not like, I don't want to like talk down. I mean, I had a fantastic experience mm-hmm. at Stanford and Rice. I had professors who were immensely passionate about both their research and about education, and I found it wonderful. But I did find that concern, I could see where that concern was coming from. And it did help inform me that, hey, the really cool thing about a faith-based institution is a lot of times that faith can give them a particular direction, right, where it becomes the overarching mission that all these other pieces fit into.
Yeah.
And so how Christianity offers me a comprehensive worldview, it also can offer an institution a comprehensive mission that has to do with, hey, we're going to take these students and we want to develop them in all these different dimensions, grow their minds, grow their thinking, but also grow them in their social lives, grow them healthy students, you know, healthy in all these dimensions, spiritually, mm-hmm. all these different ways. Here's how research fits into this. Research is a God-glorifying task. And so you could, for me, I find that the religious aspect of the institution really helps to kind of give direction to all of these different forces that otherwise be pulling me perhaps in competing directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned the types of books that you've been picking up recently is about this polarization. Are you still continuing in that type of like a reading material or like what would be, how would you pick your next book?
So that was a theme, especially I think in the fall I read a number of books about that. This spring I was reading a lot of higher ed books on the future of higher ed. There's some really interesting dynamics at play with just how the world is changing, how the economy is changing, and how that will influence the future of higher ed. So I read a number of books in that direction. I'm trying to think of College Unbound, College Disrupted. I read one really neat one. It was called Robot Proof. about how to make an higher education that's resilient to AI and how AI is going to influence the future of higher ed. That book was really neat because it talked about how in order to make higher education resilient to AI, we kind of go back to this question of what is education, which comes back to the question of what does it mean to be human? And so I was really resonating with this book, and I was like, oh, yeah, these are the right kinds of questions to be asking. What are the aspects? And it got technical as well. It was written by the president of Northwestern. And so, you know, he had some really, really good things in that book. But I enjoy these books because they kind of, you know, bring up for me, like, to answer this very small question, like a very technical question, like, oh, what kind of, how should we, what modality should our classes be offered in, or whatever it may be, you have to answer these bigger questions of what are we trying to accomplish? Right. What is education? And it's like, what is human? And it's like, oh, there's the connection between that theoretical, you know, high in the sky ambition, and this is going to play out in, you know, how I'm assessing my students or what's my learning outcomes or whatever.
And it's also it's a spiritual question, you know?
That's right, yeah. So this isn't a spiritual book at all, but you know, having that lens of faith, I'm like, oh, it convinces me all the more. The institution needs to be engaging with this question, what it means to be human, which I value being a Christian institution that does this directly. You know, we have the whole theological structure that tries to engage with what it means to be a human made in the image of God and what the implications of that for education. Yeah.
As we close out here, what would you say to be the most distinctive feature about your reading life?
I was just thinking about, like, okay, so what are the books I read? And I noticed, like, really the vast majority of them, almost all of them, are books by college professors. And many of them are, like, books that are based on a course that they have taught, now they turned into a book. Like, I recently just went through Willpower Instinct, which is a book like The Science of Self-Control, which is based on a course at Stanford that was then the author turned into a book. Yeah, so I was just thinking about that dynamic of how I often read these books that are, like, from academia, and yet I often try and find the books that are kind of the contrarian voices in academia, right? And so, like, I just read recently this book that was called Against Empathy by Bloom at Yale, where he argues it's a case against empathy, and it has convinced me to be a less empathetic professor. So I,
which
actually, I think if you read the book, you realize is maybe a good thing. So this is, you know, that's my contention. More just, less empathetic, and more compassionate. And so he makes this case against empathy, defined in a particular way.
Yeah.
It's not a case to be a Vulcan. It's not a case to be, you know, non-emotional, anything like that. It's a case for a different kind of compassion. And so I found a number of these books that are kind of from academia. So growing up, I loved Malcolm Gladwell.
Right.
When I was a freshman, I took a writing course, and my writing professor, she said, you have a Gladwellian style of writing.
Oh, and my goodness. What a compliment.
I thought it was the highest compliment. You know, I was like, oh, I love it. but since then, I've kind of, well, I still love Gladwell. I still love his books. But I have this angst towards them where it's, yeah, but a lot of times he's pulling from a lot of different fields he's not really an expert in.
Yeah.
And something that's a little bit, you know, it's like, you know, it's like you watch a 10-minute TED Talk and you're convinced of this one idea is going to change. And then you're like, oh, it's a little bit more nuanced than that.
Yeah, I understand.
I like academics because it's like when they're reporting on stuff of their own research, a lot of times a little more careful. Yeah. But then I also like the contrarian voices who are like, okay, I'm going to come in and challenge maybe some of these ideas you have. So that's kind of been the theme in my reading, which is weird because at the same time, I want to be a peacemaker and not be not be necessarily contrarian for the sake of being contrarian. But yeah, I was just reflecting on that as I was preparing. I don't think it's been intentional. I just found myself kind of gravitated towards that kind of book.
Yeah. And it's also interesting that, and I totally do the same thing, I would read in a certain, like a one vein, and I would read a series of books. And I also noticed that I would organize these topics based on semesters, kind of like still going on the academic calendar, you know, like in the fall, sometimes I go into history and then, you know, social justice or like, I noticed that it is compartmentalized into a little bit like a academic.
A professional student. Yes.
Yeah. But it's lovely, right? Like now that we're out of school, but I feel like this is just kind of like, you're like writing your own graduate course into a topic, you know, and you pick your own reading and you delve into it. And it's wonderful. It's like kind of like being in school, but then you have absolute freedom of
choosing. And I think it helps kind of guard again. Like often I read one book and I'll be like so taken by it.
Yeah.
And then I'll read another two or three in the same, and then maybe like authors have a little bit contrary views, and it's like, oh, you know, now I come out a little bit richer understanding of, right. You know, there was some strength still, but I can see how maybe it was a little bit too enchanting with what he was trying to sell, right, in that initial read. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's very important. Just understand the context. Kind of like, you know, in academia, you do like a review, paper of a field, you understand what this problem has a context, and then you can kind of like chart them, right? Cool. Okay. Yeah, that's really awesome, Anthony. I really appreciate your time. This was really fun. I hope you enjoyed it too.
I was actually a little bit nervous. I wasn't sure if I could talk about, you know, books for however long, but this has been a lot of fun. And so thank you for having me on again. This has been a blast.
Yeah. And if people would like to connect with you, do you have like a public presence or, you know, how can they connect with you? Social media or whatnot.
Social media is fine. I mean, if you search for my name, or I guess if they're friends with you, we're mutual friends, and so you can find me that way, like on Facebook. My email is just my name, anthony.bosman, B-O-S-M-A-N, @gmail.com. And so that's an easy way to reach out and follow up on any of the things we talked about here.
Mm, awesome. Well, thank you again. And looking forward to what you'll do next.
Awesome. Thanks, Josephine.